Blog Talk Radio.
Healing rain is coming down. It's coming nearer to this old town. Rich and poor, weak and strong, it's bringing mercy, it won't be long. Healing rain is coming down, it's coming closer to the lost and found. Tears of joy and tears of shame are washed forever in Jesus' name. The healing rain, it comes with fire, so let it fall and take us higher.
Good morning. Welcome to The Cross in the Desert, speaking hope and freedom to Iran. I'm your host, Randy L. Noble. So glad that you joined me for a brand new week here on The Cross in the Desert. Well, as we begin this week here in St. Louis, I think the entire nation and most of the world is aware of the situation here. About 9 days ago, an unarmed African-American man, Michael Brown, was gunned down by a police officer in a confrontation. And since then, there has been looting, racial riots, violence, tension, everything you could think of. And it's turned Ferguson into a small war zone. And now this morning, our Governor Jay Nixon has called in, finally, the National Guard to try to appease this situation and bring some calmness to the community. So this program today is not about this situation, but what I'm asking for you to do as listeners is to pray for this peace. This is a virtual racial tension war zone now, and it's been going on for, I guess, the last week. My wife, Becky, had her vacation, and the entire week she spent blogging about this situation, chatting, texting. She spent her entire week focused on what's going on here. She grew up here in Florissant and is completely in shock of how her community has been transformed into this racial war zone. So I just request your thoughts and prayers that there will be peace and stability restored once again to our community here. Ferguson is just next door to Florissant, if you can imagine. It's less than maybe a half a mile from where I'm speaking to you from, and the media has descended on our community. So I just want to say, even though today's program is not about this, I want to let you know that we're very much aware of what's going on here, and we truly need some kind of peace and reconciliation about what's happening in our community today. Today, though, on The Cross in the Desert, we have an exciting program. I have a good friend, Shabnam Esadli. She is an Iranian-Canadian human rights activist. And Shabnam was one of the persons I dedicated my new book, Chasing After Rainbows, to. She has an amazing testimony of growing up in Iran during the Iranian Revolution almost 35 or more years ago. And she's going to tell us how this entire event shaped her early life and how through all of these circumstances that she encountered and went through, that she found a vibrant personal relationship with Christ. Now, Shabnam was a person, she will tell you, that hated God. And so it's an amazing thing that happened to Shabnam. She's going to share that with us in the next 20 minutes or so. I want to also turn our attention today towards the war zone in Iraq. All of us are aware of the situation with the Yazidis in Shingar Mountain, the Christians in Iraq, the genocide that is going on, and of course we're involved now in a humanitarian way by providing food and clothing and things to the Yazidis and Christians, and also focusing airstrikes on trying to stop this brutal group known as ISIS. So I want to bring us up to date about the latest happenings in Iraq, and what I want to do is refocus us on a situation that has just gripped all of our hearts, and that is the genocide that ISIS is trying to commit in Iraq against Christians. I want you to hear this interview that Sean Hannity had on his Fox News program about the genocide going on in Iraq. We're going to listen to it right now on the cross in the desert.
For weeks we have heard about ISIS using barbaric tactics like beheadings, live burials, and even crucifixions on innocent adults. But now they are allegedly targeting any kids who happen to get in their way of their goal of creating this Islamic caliphate. Joining me now with much more on the genocide that is happening in Iraq are Assyrian Christian activist Narain and Anwaye, and also Chaldean American spokesman Mark Arabo is with us. Narain, I think we need to explain to the world exactly what's going on here. 95% of Christians have been kicked out of their homes, told to convert or die. Now they're doing what to children?
Yes, thank you for having me again, Sean. They are at full force with this genocide, and I believe the president is very well aware of it, and he has known about this for quite some time. And I don't believe he understands the urgency of this genocide. And actually, I have spoken to thousands of Assyrians, including our Chaldean and Syriac churches, and they are extremely upset that his previous statements that he made was basically, he said he was striking Iraq to only protect the American personnel, which is amazing, but he needs to understand, he needs to acknowledge the fact that there is an Assyrian, Chaldean, Syriac genocide. It's an extermination of the world's oldest civilization, not only the world's oldest Christians, but they are basically destroying our identity, and our people are very upset, and we just can't believe that he's handling this.
Well, Narain, I think
we don't
one
have much
point.
Time to spare.
Right now they hold territories in both Iraq and Syria that are about the size of Belgium. But their tactics are more brutal than any other group before it. I want you to explain to everybody specifically now, because these are the areas now that they are now covering and holding, and as they make their way and surround even Baghdad, I want you to explain exactly what methods they're using.
Oh, yes. They're basically, I mean, they will cut off a child's head with a small knife slowly because they believe in these old tactics that they used when Islam was extremely fierce. And, you know, any of the, also the Muslims that have lived in peace with the Christians, they're dying. And I want the president to understand that this is a direct attack against Christianity. The Muslims that are dying with us, they're dying because they were friends with us. But the marking on the homes of Christians with the N, which is for Nazarene, a Christian, this is the same way that the Germans did to the Jewish community in Germany with the Holocaust. This is a Holocaust. He needs to acknowledge that this is a Holocaust. They're being beheaded. Their heads are being stuffed with wires, and they're hanging them on fences. I mean, the worst things you can imagine, worse than a horror film. And this is happening to innocent families that did not declare war. They're not striking anyone with missiles. We're Christians. We want to live in peace, and we're constantly being attacked with genocide.
Yeah. Convert,
and I'm requesting that he needs to... Yes, exactly. We need a safe haven from the president. We're not requesting a land that does not belong
Mark
to
this.
Us.
Mark,
we need,
let me bring you in here. Because this is now, radical Islamists have always said they want to wipe Israel off the map. They want a modern-day Holocaust. Now it's the genocide of Christians that is happening. And the world, especially the United States, I think should have a far more significant role in battling back against one of the most brutal, ambitious, ruthless terror groups ever. And I don't think these pinprick strikes of the president are going to make a whole hell of a lot of a difference.
Mm-hmm.
Mark?
Well, I could tell you this. Yeah, sure. Thank you for having me. This is a full-blown genocide. Men are being massacred, women are being raped, and children are being beheaded. We have 400,000 Christians that are displaced from their homes. They are dying from thirst, from hunger. They don't have diapers. They don't have clothes. This issue will be dealt with by the next president of the United States. This should be the number one issue in the next presidential election primary, because it's an open-ended one. We have to make sure that America stands as the light of the world, which we are. Right now, France is leading the way by offering asylum to these folks. And in a couple of days, I'm going to the United Nations, myself and a few Chaldean leaders in Michigan, to ask for three things. We're going to ask for the UN to recognize this as a genocide. We're going to ask them to recognize this as crimes against humanity. And we're going to ask them to recognize this as a systematic wiping off of all those Christians in the history of the world.
These are stateless
Mark, people.
You said they're beheading children and putting their heads on a stick to incite fear into the hearts of everybody?
Mm-hmm.
These are the most horrific atrocities that the world has ever seen. A Christian Holocaust lays within our midst, and we owe it to humanity to do something. We need to act.
Noreen, last word.
Yes, and honestly, I am an Assyrian American before anything, and I'm not only concerned about our people there, but my people here. These people are on a streak to basically destroy anything in their past that does not believe in their ideology. I mean, the president has to understand the depth and the urgency of this matter. He needs to attack it with full force. There's a reason why we have an army. There's a reason why we have our Marines. There's a reason why we have our Navy. We have a right to protect ourselves, too. He needs to attack this. He needs to attack this beast with full force. This is a global crisis, a humanitarian crisis, and action needs to be taken soon. We're all very concerned for everyone.
All right, guys. We're going to continue to follow the story with.
And there you have it, a passionate appeal to the Obama administration to do more than just drop food and water and make airstrikes. So the question is to you today, do you think we're doing all we can do to put a stop to this brutal terrorist group? I want you to think about it. Come to my page and comment. Come to the chat room here on the Cross in the Desert / the Conservative Cauldron. Let me hear what you have to say. It's important what you think. After all, this is why the show is successful. It's because of listeners like yourself. Do you think we're doing all we can do to stop this genocide in Iraq? Let me hear from you in the chat room here. This is important. I want to hear your feedback. We're going to continue on this theme of the genocide in Iraq, and this is a special news report on Iraqi Christians facing the heartless enemy in Mosul right now on the Cross in the Desert.
Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki condemned the attack on Christians in Iraq by the Islamic State extremist group. He said Christians have been exposed to violent acts that have never been witnessed before in Iraq. Sunni militants told them to convert to Islam, pay a tax, or face death.
There are no Christians left in Mosul, Gary. They've all been driven out. They were stripped of all their possessions. They were left with nothing. Their houses, which were stamped Nazarene, meaning Christian, and then stamped again, saying a property of the Islamic State. Their cars, even their wedding rings, sometimes with their fingers attached if the rings wouldn't come off.
An official with the Nineveh governor's office says only 25 Christian families remain in Mosul. Al-Maliki pledged to protect the Christians, but so far his government has been helpless. The director of the Center for Religious Freedom at the Hudson Institute, Nina Shea, says the Christians are facing a heartless enemy.
They hate Christians. The villages that they have not conquered on the Nineveh area surrounding Mosul, they have turned off their waters. It's 120 degrees in there today. They said to them, you don't deserve water.
Not only are Islamists targeting believers, they're also destroying all traces of Christianity in the area. Video has surfaced showing Islamists destroying the tombs of biblical prophets Jonah and Seth.
This is a very ancient city that goes back to biblical times. I did see that video as well. They have also captured ancient monasteries from the 4th century, and they are burning the ancient early Christian manuscripts. These are priceless for the heritage of Christianity.
And then there's the refugee crisis. UN officials say around 2 million refugees and internally displaced people from Iraq and Syria reside in the northern Iraqi region of Kurdistan. Mark Martin, CBN News.
Well, the broadcast you heard is a little bit dated because Maliki has stepped down since then as president of Iraq. And I want to bring you to some more statistics, horrifying statistics about what's happening to the Christians, to the Yazidis, to all the minority groups in Iraq. And as I think of what's happening in the Middle East, and I think about what's happening in my own backyard, and of course, what's happening in my own backyard, it's a terrible situation. Don't misunderstand me. But it's nothing. It's nothing compared to the atrocities, to the human rights that are being destroyed in the Middle East and in Iraq. And while much of the nation is now focused on my backyard, I hope that the nation and the world keeps their focus on the Middle East. These are people that are genuinely suffering, that are hurting, that are dying for their faith every day. So let's continue to hear some more about this on the cross in the desert.
Let me go back to you, Mark. We showed some tape here. They taunt America. They taunt Europe. You see young kids that have been brainwashed and indoctrinated into this radicalism, and they talk about the caliphate. John Brennan, CIA director back in 2011, I'm going to play the tape, literally said, senior advisor to Obama, said that the idea of an Islamic caliphate is absurd. I want to play you his words and get your reaction to this. Let's roll this tape.
Our strategy is also shaped by a deeper understanding of Al-Qaeda's goals, strategy, and tactics that we have gained over the last decade. I'm not talking about Al-Qaeda's grandiose vision of global domination through a violent Islamic caliphate. That vision is absurd, and we are not going to organize our counterterrorism policies against a feckless delusion that is never going to happen. We are not going to elevate these thugs and their murderous aspirations into something larger than they are.
Isn't Israel, those that want to wipe Israel off the map, aren't they facing those that have a desire for a caliphate? Isn't convert or die a push by now the most radical Islamic radicals that are out there? Isn't that a push for their genocide? Isn't that an example of a caliphate that they're pushing?
You know, it absolutely is, because ISIS knows no boundaries. They just changed their name to ICE. They're going country to country, and they want to eradicate Christianity.
How can the CIA director of this president be so wrong?
He was completely out of touch. And I could tell you from my people that are being massacred because they're refusing to convert. All they want right now is a chance to live. And
how many people do you estimate have been massacred?
Thousands. We are at least every day around 500 since it started.
Wow.
So you're talking 8 weeks and 500, 40,000 at least.
You think 40,000 so far, 40,000 people have been slaughtered?
Either slaughtered or died because they don't have food, water, diapers, clothes. This is a global humanitarian crisis. And the next president, whether it be Rubio or Clinton, they would have to fix this problem.
How naive of the CIA director to say that this caliphate, that this situation could never escalate to where it is now. Well, open your eyes, it has. And our naivety is just ridiculous. I cannot believe that we would be so unfocused and unconnected. But the reality is here, and we must do something immediately to confront this. And while I'm grateful for the humanitarian effort to help the Yazidis and the airstrikes, I think there needs to be something more. But I want to hear your feedback. Come to the chat room here, the Conservative Cauldron / Cross in the Desert, if you're listening. Give me your feedback on what you think more should be done to help the Christians in Iraq. This is where my focus is. This is where my heart is, to see these people get the justice that they deserve. Now, in light of this whole discussion about ISIS, we have this continual conflict between radical Islam and so-called moderate Islam. Well, about 3 months ago, Bridget Gabriel was on a panel discussion, and she was asked a question in light of modern Islam, moderate Islam, and radical Islam, and she answered this question, I thought, brilliantly. I want you to hear this dialogue right now on the cross in the desert.
Assalamualaikum. Peace to you all. My name is Saba Ahmed. I'm a law student at American University. I am here to ask you a simple question. I know that we portray Islam and all Muslims as bad, but there's 1.8 billion Muslim followers of Islam. We have 8 million plus Muslim Americans in this country, and I don't see them represented here. But my question is, how can we fight an ideological war with weapons? How can we ever end this war? The jihadist ideology that you talk about, it's an ideology. How can you ever win this thing if you don't address it ideologically?
Great question. I am so glad you're here, and I am so glad you brought that up because it gives us an opportunity to answer. What I find so amazing is since the beginning of this panel, which we are here about Benghazi attack against our people, not one person mentioned Muslims. We are here against Islam, or we're launching war against Muslims. We are here to discuss how 4 Americans died and what our government is doing. We were not here to bash Muslims. You were the one who brought up the issue about most Muslims, not us. And since you brought it up, allow me to elaborate with my answer. There are 1.2 billion Muslims in the world today. Of course not all of them are radicals. The majority of them are peaceful people. The radicals are estimated to be between 15 to 25% according to all intelligence services around the world. That leaves 75% of them peaceful people. But when you look at 15 to 25% of the world Muslim population, you're looking at 180 million to 300 million people dedicated to the destruction of Western civilization. That is as big as the United States. So why should we worry about the radical 15 to 25%? Because it is the radicals that kill. Because it is the radicals that behead and massacre. When you look throughout history, when you look at all the lessons of history, most Germans were peaceful. Yet the Nazis drove the agenda. And as a result, 60 million people died, almost 14 million in concentration camps, 6 million were Jews. The peaceful majority were irrelevant. When you look at Russia, most Russians were peaceful as well. Yet the Russians were able to kill 20 million people. The peaceful majority were irrelevant. When you look at China, for example, most Chinese were peaceful as well. Yet the Chinese were able to kill 70 million people. The peaceful majority were irrelevant. When you look at Japan prior to World War II, most Japanese were peaceful as well. Yet Japan was able to butcher its way across Southeast Asia, killing 12 million people, mostly killed with bayonets and shovels. The peaceful majority were irrelevant. On September 11th in the United States, we had 2.3 million Arab Muslims living in the United States. It took 19 hijackers, 19 radicals to bring America down to its knees, destroy the World Trade Center, attack the Pentagon, and kill almost 3,000 Americans that day. The peaceful majority were irrelevant. So for all our powers of reasons and us talking about moderate and peaceful Muslims, I'm glad you're here. But where are the others speaking out? And since you are the only Muslim representative, thank you, applause till the end. Only Muslim representative in here, you took the limelight instead of speaking about why our government, and I assume, are you an American? You're an American citizen. So as an American citizen, you sat in this room and instead of standing up and saying a question or asking something about our four Americans that died and what our government is doing to correct the problem, you stood there to make a point about peaceful, moderate Muslims. I wish you brought 10 with you to question about how we can hold our government responsible. It is time we take political correctness and throw it in the garbage where it belongs and stop calling it fair.
Well, I think that is a brilliant answer by Bridget Gabriel. She deals with this whole political correctness that is squelching honest answers to honest dialogue, and she unveils that the peaceful, quote-unquote, majority of Muslims is irrelevant when that 15 to 20% destroys Western civilization, attacks innocent people, and creates this vacuum of violence. And I think this is probably one of the most insightful answers I've heard. And, you know, we need to deal honestly with this situation. And she brought up all of these different historical examples to buttress her case. Well, this dialogue actually continues. This is a short audio clip of the same two representatives on the Hannity show. And this was after this confrontation. Let's listen.
Joining me now to discuss that exchange in their first television interview since the panel is Islamic lobbyist Saba Ahmed, as well as ACT for America's Brigitte Gabriel is with us. Saba, let me start with you, because Brigitte was making a point. This was supposed to be about four dead Americans. This was supposed to be about Benghazi. You're given the microphone, and you start talking about, I guess, I sense the treatment of Muslims in America. Why was your focus there and not on what the forum was about?
The forum was talking about Islamic jihadists, so I asked a question about Islam. I didn't see how that was irrelevant. It was directly related to what the panel was about.
Brigitte?
The panel was discussing the attack on Benghazi, our four dead Americans, and what our government is doing or not doing about it to get to the bottom of the problem. The whole symposium was about Benghazi, and she took the limelight instead of standing up as an American, caring about how four Americans, our fellow Americans, are dead, asking something about what we can do to hold our government accountable. The whole panel was about accountability, yet she took the limelight asking a question that was completely not discussed out of the blue. She might as well be asking about why are we wearing green today?
Do you think that women in some countries that need four male eyewitnesses, if they to prove rape, will you at least speak out against that?
Well, yeah, rape is horrible, of course.
So under Sharia law, that's wrong.
But Sharia law does not require to prove adultery. You need four witnesses, and that would have to be like so public.
And women are stoned to death under Sharia? Homosexuals are stoned to death under Sharia?
Sean, a lot of bad things happen around the world, and people have been misusing the religion.
But this is happening in the name of your religion, which is my point. This is your religion, and I have every belief you're probably very moderate in your own personal views. But this is happening in the name of your religion.
And so
if as a Catholic it was happening in the name of my religion, like the sex scandal, I spoke out. I said it was intolerable. So will you speak out?
Of course, yeah.
Let me hear you speak out then.
Well, I'm speaking out. I'm against a lot of the, you know, barbaric practices around the world. I think Islam has been misused by a lot of people.
Guys, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you both for being with us. Appreciate it.
I think the willingness for most Muslims to speak out against the radicals, I think it's there, but they're afraid. There's a lot of fear that goes in. And it's very difficult to get those that are Muslims to admit that there are many, many atrocities committed by so-called radical Muslims. And I really believe that there are, like I said, there are many Muslims that would like to openly say this is wrong. They would like to condemn the attacks by ISIS in Iraq. They would like to say that the stoning of women, that rape of women is wrong, that women should not be punished in Muslim countries for being raped. I think they want to legitimately speak out. But the reason they don't is fear. Fear of having a fatwa issued against them, a legal term for a Muslim cleric to issue punishment for them. They are afraid of the repercussions of speaking out. And I think that that is one of the biggest problems we're having. We want more Muslims to speak out against the atrocities, but they're not willing to do so, many of them because of political correctness, but also most of them because of fear. Well, I'm awaiting Shabnam to call into our program. We're going to shift gears now from the Middle East over to Iran. And I'm just so excited about my next guest who's going to be on live from Canada. She's going to call into the program and talk about her testimony growing up in Iran during the Iranian Revolution. And Shabnam is a very outspoken Iranian-Canadian. And she believes in justice for her people. And she looks at what's happening to many of the people in Iran that I'm sure are her friends. And she's going to discuss that today with us on The Cross in the Desert. My guest, Shabnam, has now just arrived, and I'm going to bring her on to The Cross in the Desert. Welcome to The Cross in the Desert, Shabnam and Sadali. So glad that you could join us this morning for the program.
Good morning, Randy. Thank you so much again for having me on your show, and this is a blessing.
Well, Shabnam, I just was sharing with our audience that my newest book, Chasing After Rainbows, Stories of the Revolution, is dedicated to you and to your story of growing up during the Iranian Revolution. But before we talk about that, I would like our listeners to get to know you a little bit. So tell me what it is you do, what is your job, and let us know how you are so passionate about human rights.
First of all, thank you so much. That's an honor to have you dedicated your book to me and to another colleague of mine, Ms. Shadi Pave. This is I was very, very blessed when I heard about that and when I read your email telling us that you dedicated your book to us. And what I do, it's first of all, I'm a human being who cares about humanity. And I grew up in Iran until age 17 and a half. I was in Iran, and I left Iran after that age, and I went to Turkey for almost 7.5 years, and I did most of my university studies in Turkey, and then in 1991, together with my family, we came to Canada. We live in Canada since then, and I have been working with immigrants and refugees for the last 22 years being in Canada. And I studied social anthropology, mostly the major was in culture, and I have been in that field since I finished my university. I did a lot of radio programming. When I arrived to Canada, I worked with Transworld Radio for over 6 years, and I translated 8 books into English from into Persian from English, and aired them on radio, which was aired through Monte Carlo and Albania, former Albania. To mm-hmm. Iran, Afghanistan, and Tajikistan, and my programs were geared to children and youth, and they were all Christian programming. What I do right now, again, I'm still in the same field of working with immigrants and newcomers, and I work with a school board, continuing education, and I teach newcomers English as a second language and life skill. I worked for a few years with an immigrant-serving NGO, nonprofit organization. I was an education counselor in Ottawa. I lived for 8 years in British Columbia before I arrived to Ottawa, the national capital of Canada. And over there again, I worked with Transworld Radio and with nonprofit agency, working with newcomers and in the housing area. So this is all about me. I have been in the field of human rights, I think, forever, since I was 13 years old and the revolution or devolution happened in Iran and the invasion, first invasion of Ayatollah Khomeini in Iran. I don't know if I answered your question.
No, but you actually really let us know a little bit about yourself. And, of course, the key word, Shabnam, that you used is human rights. 35 years of no freedom, 35 years of women being transformed into a second-class citizen, 35 years of political prisoners, of death and destruction. As a human rights activist, your heart has to break when you think of 35 years that Iran has been transformed into just a state of terrorism.
Yes, it is very difficult, and you know, you wake up in the morning and you're just expecting to see what's up again in Iran. And I believe that the whole atrocities in the world started from the revolution in Iran by Ayatollah Khomeini, because it was his vision to export his mafia Islam to the world. I have utmost respect for all religions and people of all faiths and minority groups. But my attention when I talk about Islam is not attacking any religion. It's about Islamism, and it's about the mafia Islam that Ayatollah Khomeini started just to bring division between different sects in Islam, and also just to destroy the world and to control the Middle East, and also slowly to have a control in the Western society. If you go back to prior to 1979 Iranian devolution, we did not have so much of atrocities. We did not hear about Islamist terrorism, did we, Randy? If you
No.
go back to 35 years ago. When Khomeini was in France, his main goal was exporting Islam, his Islam, to the world. Mm-hmm. He didn't care about Iran, the country that he was born into. He had no nationalism in him, because he always said that religion has no nationality. When you look at the past, I think, you know, he's vision has been accomplished, and what you see today's world, it's what he wanted to have. And Ayatollah Khamenei is continuing his goal.
Yes. I didn't mean to interrupt you. I had a quote here about what you just said about him not really caring about Iran, but about his version of Islam. He was asked by Peter Jennings on the flight to Iran from Paris. Peter Jennings asked Khomeini, February 1st, 1979, Ayatollah, would you be so kind as to tell us how you feel about being back in Iran? Nothing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't feel anything.
And do you know that the person who was his interpreter, Mr. Ghotzadeh, who later was executed by the same Khomeini that who he brought to power, did not interpret that in transparency. He did not quote that in English. It was terrible. But he said nothing. And I vividly remember, I was just like a teenager, I was only 13 years old, 13 or barely 14, and I remember I was watching him on the airplane when he was saying that, and I was shocked. Like, you know, a teenager, what does a teenager understand about all these things? But then you know, we all thought that, you know, this is the end of the civilization in Iran. Persia, enormous empire of Persia, the same minute Ayatollah Khomeini said nothing on the airplane.
Yes.
And unfortunately, I blame the nation, too, for all these happenings. Because, you know, Randy, democracy is not given. Democracy is earned. And
yes.
I believe that, you know, I have been following the path of Iranians, you know, after the revolution. And I think that they just follow what they are told. You know, they listen to media, and probably this is very cultural in almost all cultures and nations, that people are under the influence of mainstream media. But Iranians, they're under a huge influence of that religion, that mafia religion, and also the media. Media, we can talk about like what France has done, and they had a big role in empowering Ayatollah Khomeini, because when he was in Nofelo Chateau, where he lived in exile, every day he was given 5 minutes free radio programming by the French government to Iranians. Nobody knew about the existence of this mullah. Nobody. But the mainstream media made Ayatollah Khomeini a hero. And Iranians were not very happy with the dictatorship of Shah. He made a lot of mistakes. I am not a fan of monarchism, but he, you know, when you are comparing Shah and comparing what is happening in Iran, and the, you know, well, you just feel like, you know, we wish we never had Shah overthrown. But unfortunately, when you look at, you know, what happened during the 2009 elections, Iranians went everywhere on the street and said to Obama, "Obama, are you with them or are you with us?" They said no to Gaza, only for Iran. And then, you know, 8 years later, the very same Iranians, they went and they voted for who? For another mullah who had a huge role in this imperialism, this dictatorship of Ayatollah Khomeini, Mr. Mullah Rouhani, who brought Khomeini to power. And, you know, we were all attacked. You know, we were all attacked during this. You know, I think you followed what was going on, all of us on Facebook, that how we were attacked when we raised our voices against the recent elections in Iran, and everybody wanted to just silence us because they said we are wrong and we have to allow Iranians to go on polls, on the polls, and vote for this new government, because they wanted to choose again between bad and worse. And they chose, I think they chose worse.
Well, when you look at the track record, Shabnam, since Rouhani has been president, and Shadi pointed this out to me on a program she did with me, executions have tripled. They've gone through the ceiling. So we're looking at all of these so-called reforms freedom for political prisoners. Rouhani promised a little bit more freedom on the internet. The wearing of the hijab during the summer heat, we're supposed to scale that back so that women can have a little bit more hair showing and that the heat. All of these so-called little bitty promises, and Rouhani has failed on all of them. And
Randy,
so they have
Randy,
voted again for a mullah.
Let me just open a quote in here, just a parenthesis.
Yes.
Nobody is considering that when people are voting under the Islamic Republic of Iran, they are voting for the very same constitution. They are endorsing the very same constitution which brought this regime to power. And the head of this constitution is the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khomeini,
yes.
Ayatollah Khamenei. So there is no difference. You go to the polls and you elect somebody. The same person is like over 34 years, 35 years under the same constitution, the Islamic Republic of Iran. Islamic Republic of Iran cannot be reformed. It has to be
right.
Overthrown.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like I pointed out in my book, Shabnam, the word reform. I have a character here that is arguing for reform, and my character, Sahar, is this human rights activist, is not reform, remove.
Exactly. You know, can we reform Islam? Just a question. Is there any way that we can just talk about reform of Islam?
Mm.
Can you talk to someone who believes in that religion that there should be some reform? They're talking about moderate Muslims. They're talking about extremist Muslims. I always talk about non-practicing and practicing Muslims. And, you know, everybody can have their own opinion and their own religion, but religion is very private. You cannot mix religion with the state. I have to practice my own faith in my own home. I cannot pressure anybody just to tell them that you have to become a Christian. It's the same thing. You cannot mix religion with the state. It has to be separated. And otherwise, we cannot have peace. There's no way to have peace.
Under the Shah, there was no mix of religion and politics. And, of course, when Khomeini came into power, you have the Islamic State, where you blend Islam with the state, and that's why
exactly.
you have no freedom.
Was a very religious person. We should always remember that he himself was under influence of religion. But then he had no – I don't think he had much power because of the clergy. Clergy influenced Shah. And also clergy pressured Shah, and the nation was 99% of Iranians are Muslims. So it was very difficult to have a cultural revolution. You know, when Ataturk came to power in Turkey, he made a huge cultural revolution, and he just like wiped out everything as Shah's late father did. Reza Pahlavi did the same thing, Reza Shah. But I don't think Shah was that. I believe that Shah was a bit more naive than, you know, his father. And I do believe that his son is naive as his father was. And there is no way that, you know, that's why we don't see a very strong opposition outside of Iran, which Western countries can rely on. And then, we have seen that what NEK has done. And then they started just coming out as the opposition group. But we don't have a very thorough and a strong opposition anti the Iranian regime. And this is one of the unfortunate matters that Iran is struggling. And the other thing is we don't have a very strong media among Persian groups. It's all about me, and it's all about my ego, and it's all about what I think. And, you know, I wasn't planning to talk about politics in this interview. I want to talk about Jesus. Jesus is missing in the hearts and the souls of the Iranians. And the day that they left Jesus Christ, all these came to Iran, and the darkness, shadow of darkness, spread over that land. You know, we read in the Bible that, and in the books that after Zoroastrian religion was in power in Iran, and when Apostle Paul traveled to that area, the very first missionary who went to China was from Persia. And 60% of the population of Iranian became Christian after Zoroastrians. When Prophet Muhammad and his very buddy friend Salman Farsi, they had this trade between each other. Prophet Muhammad exported Islam into Iran and changed the language of Persians and the writing of Persians from the language they had, from Pahlavi, to the Arabic writing. So we lost all the alphabet. We lost the culture. We lost the religion. So they built the Silk Road with the body of those 60% Christian Iranians, and they killed them all. So what happened? They were part, you know, they became the slaves of Arabs in the war. And then, you know, one after one, we had very naive kings who were under the influence of that religion. And then they enforced the religion into the culture of the people. And look at the results. It is very difficult to change that. And I do believe that the only way is, number one, education is the only road to freedom and democracy. Number two is Iranians have to give their hearts and souls to Christ.
Shevnan, I agree with that completely. There is a light in the darkness of Iran, and that light, which is the title of one of my books, A Light in the Darkness of Iran, Shining Star, it's about Christ. You're right, completely right. There is an underground church, a house church movement that is sweeping across Iran. Iranians are finding the joy, the peace, the fulfillment in Jesus, and at the risk of their own lives, they are standing up for Jesus in Iran. So I see exactly what you're saying. That underground church is so strong in Iran, and Islam, the Iranian government, they're really afraid of this movement of Christianity. That's why when a Muslim converts to Christianity in Iran and they face the – I see that vision. There is the only hope for Iran is Christ. But I want to take us back to something you said before you became a Christian I thought was very, very interesting. In your early life in Iran, you said, and I quote you in my book, "I did not think that a simple conversation, having an opinion and simply expressing it, would put my life in danger." Tell us about your childhood, your early life in Iran, and how all of this led to Christ.
You know, my personality type is I don't follow anything that is dictated to me, anything. I have to question it. And it's just like I don't believe easily. I have to read it. I have to experience it. Even, you know, if you come and just say, Shabnam, this person is doing this to me, I have to really have all the evidence to believe in whatever anybody says to me. So because of that character, you know, over the night, you open your eyes in the morning that there is a new regime. And I was a girl. And in Islam, in real Islam, a girl at age 9 has to cover. And then, you know, I have to go out. I had to cover my head from head to toe. I was into dark clothing. Like the early revolution, we were forced to wear dark clothes, like very, very dark brown, dark navy blue, black. That was the color of our uniform in high school. And because I was 14 years old when I was 16 when I finished my high school, almost finished because I was arrested. But I went to school 2 years before anybody else, and I was kind of tested as genius and had to go to a genius school. And then revolution happened, and I was in early high school time. So then, okay, over the night, we all had to cover our hair as girls. And before that, we had mixed schools, like girls and boys. We were all in the same class when I was in intermediate school. But in high school, no, everything was divided. So we had to study Quran. That was part of the subject that it was inserted to high school curriculum, and also Arabic language. These two were inserted into our curriculum. And I started questioning God. There's no God. if this is the last religion, and if this is the last religion that Almighty God has sent, and this is the last prophet was sent from God, and so it must be the most democratic religion and advanced religion. So why do I have to believe in this religion? Because this doesn't look advanced. And there is no democracy in this religion because there is no equality between men and women. That is my question when I was just a little girl. And even bicycling, even biking as a girl was forbidden early revolution because they were saying that your body part shows, so you cannot
yes.
bike. So they took away everything from us as teenagers, and every power was given to man, male-dominating religion. So I started believing, well, if this is the last religion God sent, so there is no God. So period.
Yes.
I don't believe in God because I don't like this God. This God is hurting me, and this God is torturing everybody. So I started having more kind of leaning towards more atheism and communism because that was the wave during that time among teenagers and youth. And many teenagers and youth in university, in high school, they started turning to communism and going towards left parties and accepting the left. That was the main question I had. I was asking questions in the school. I was standing up in Arabic and Quran classes during, you know, regular school days, and I was questioning my teachers. So everybody hated me because I had a big mouth. So that having a big mouth, still I have, they say, caused a huge trouble to me and to my family because an Iranian girl who was 1 year or 2 years before me, I was in last year of high school, I think she was 2 years before me, she was arrested and she was a same person or follower of MEK group, Mujahideen. So under torture, when they ask her about, you know, who is involved, who is in politics, who is doing the stuff in your high school, she gives my name. I even didn't know her, but because I had the mic all the time in the school, in my hands, and I was reading and talking and protesting against the staff. So obviously, I flagged myself to that woman. So under the torture, you know, you don't blame the person. You know, imagine a 14-year-old kid being tortured, severely tortured. Of course, she just gave my name as the head of the militia group, the leftist communist militia group. And I was barely... Like, I was only, I think I was 45 kilograms, something like that. I was very slim. I wasn't a tall girl at that age. Still, I'm not very tall. I'm just, like average height. So I finished my pre-entrance exams for the high school. And then I was waiting for the final exams for my high school, and just to then we were going to go to another city of Shiraz to go to University of Shiraz, and I wanted my parents really, really wanted me to go to that university, and I was planning to go to medical school there. So what happened while I'm waiting for 2 weeks study time, somebody knocked on your door, on our door, and my father was in the city and was building a house for us so we all could move to that city of Shiraz. My dad wasn't home and my mom was asleep. It was 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I opened the door and I saw someone in chador, a young girl, in wearing a black, like a hijab, like a long black hijab. And she asked me if I was Shabnam. And then I felt like, who is this woman and why is she knocking at my door? I said, excuse me, who are you? And then suddenly an IRGC militia came from her behind with a rifle. And then she said, are you Shabnam? And I said, no. I don't know.
Right?
No, I'm not Shabnam. And then the guy said, you're not Shabnam. And then I said, no. And they said, they're coming from Evin prison, and we want to search your house. I was shocked. I just, like, I was nobody. I didn't even do anything. I was just questioning. I wasn't really politically active because my dad was extremely protective of me, and he would never allow me even to go to any gatherings or to my friend's house. Everybody had to come to our house if they wanted to see me. Even I wasn't allowed to go to birthday parties. My dad was extremely overprotective. I was the only child, the oldest child and the only girl in my family, and imagine, like, the love of a father for her daughter. So I wasn't allowed to do any political activism. Imagine that, you know, what have I done to be the head of the militia party at age 16? What can I contribute? So what happened, I said no, and then they all came in and said, Yana Chabna, and I said, well, any donkey monkey, a stranger, like I use donkey, a stranger coming, entering, you know, if I literally translate it, entering and knocking at my door and buzzing a door, do I have to really identify myself? Who the hell are you?
True.
And then the guy says, we came here for Evin prison. So there were two motorcycles. I think they were one Mercedes and two other regular Persian car called Paycon. I remember this very vividly. So when all of these people came to arrest this little, barely 50-kilogram, like 45-kilogram girl as a head of the militia for the eastern of Tehran, you imagine, a 10 million. That time, I think Tehran had 9 or 10 million population. Imagine. Eastern, the whole eastern Tehran. They said, they accused me of, I was head of that area. So then, you know, they searched the whole house. They could not even find a piece of paper indicating that we are political. But later on, when I was, taken to Evin, but I just go back to later on when I was freed, my mother told me that she was sleeping, and she, you know, I had to go knock on my mom's door and say, Mom, there's somebody wants to talk to you, because I didn't want to give her the shock. But you imagine, my mother at that time, she made to the kitchen, she made very sweet sugary drink for me because she saw that I am pale and I'm shaking, and she noticed that probably my blood pressure is low. She gave me that drink to have it, so then I would stop shaking. My mother,
wow,
they came to take her daughter. She did this to empower her own daughter, to give her energy. So my mom said, she asked, my little brother was like, my youngest brother was 4 years old. My other brother, I probably 12 years old or maybe 10, 12 years old. He told my two brothers to each go to different rooms and watch these people, what they do when they were searching every single room. Because we had some company from another town. I think my cousin was there, and my mom asked my cousin to go and just watch oversee to see what they do. So as my mom was entering to the guest spare bedroom, she noticed that one of these revolutionary guards was putting his pistol into a shoebox in our house. He removed his pistol. I had no idea about this. He removed his pistol, put it in, and my mom arrived, and she took the man's wrist and said, hey, brother, we don't have this kind of games in our house. What are you doing? Oh, my hand was a bit heavy, so I just wanted to put my pistol down. They could not find a piece of paper against us, and if they put that pistol in that box, we all would have been executed by now.
That is amazing that didn't happen.
I do believe Jesus protected me. I do believe deep in my heart, despite that my hate for God and for any religion, Jesus over there picked me from day one, and he wrote my name in his book that he would protect me forever.
Yes.
Until I live in this
very
world.
It's very interesting how you explain, as you look back, you saw that the hand of God was on your life, and of course you weren't a Christian at that time. This whole testimony that you're sharing with us, I want to mention to our listeners, you can get it from your page and from mine at the McKenzie Institute. It's a wonderful article. I've shared this at my book signing, Shabnam, with my customers who've taken it home. But the thing that's so striking about your testimony is that when you got to Evin Prison, which, by the way, Evin Prison is notorious for rape and for torture and for endless hours of interrogation, when you got to prison, in your story, you recounted counting the bullets at night. Mm-hmm. And it's horrifying. Explain to our listeners, what's the significance of you counting the gunshots and the bullets at night?
You know, every day they were calling the prisoners, because there were mass executions in Iran in early 80s during the ruling of Ayatollah Khamenei as the president and Mr. Mousavi as his prime minister. So, and Ayatollah Khomeini as the supreme leader. There were mass executions, hundreds and hundreds of executions every day. I think the first, the early 80s, there were around, at least around 100,000 Iranians executed, from ministers of Shah to university professors, and all educated people, and also the high school students. Like, it's just like, and they have mass graves. So they were calling us. We were waking up like 4 o'clock in the morning. We were counting. And at first, we were hearing the one kind of a shotgun, just like that. So then we were hearing bullet by bullet, 1, 2, 3. So they were collecting overnight. They were collecting all those people who repented. The politically active Iranians who repented under the torture and became part of the Revolutionary Guard forces in Evin. So those people were among us. We didn't know they were spies for the guards in Evin prison. They were calling those people up the stairs, and then they were not coming until the next day. So they were putting all those bullets over the heads of the executed people. Not the Revolutionary Guard forces. Only those people who repented. And unfortunately, there are many of them among us. And, for sure that under the torture, people can give information. But doing such thing, and, you know, if I did something like that, something horrible like that, I would be bold enough to talk about it. That's what the regime had forced me doing it. But those people, they use it, but also they are making themselves of a hero. That, you know, as if they were in Iran's prisons and they had contributed to the political growth of the anti-regime. But those were the days that, you know, for 6 months in Evin, because I stayed in Evin for 6 months, then after that we were transferred to Bezel Hisar prison in Karaj City near Tehran to stay there, and, you know, to finish my term in Evin, but my sentence in Evin. But for the first 6 months, every day from 8 o'clock in the morning till 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I was put behind the torture room to hear the voice of people being tortured every day for 6 months. And it's very difficult for me to watch. Like, you know, sometimes you watch movies that they have very violent scenes. I still cannot watch those. I don't like people. When people yell, it really bothers me. But I overcome all my trauma because I think Jesus healed me. My only counselor was Jesus Christ. And I did not need anybody else. I didn't need a doctor. I didn't need a medication. I had never taken even a single sleeping pill in my life. Jesus healed me. And the day I accepted him as my Savior and as my God, as my counselor, I received that ultimate joy that all the Christians have, and where I was seeking for that joy. Many times they put me...
I'm sorry. I just wanted to interject to you. You were talking and describing. You mentioned in your article that you were actually spared some of the torture that everyone else was enduring. And so I was just following up by saying, Shabnam, even at that time, whether you knew it or not, God was protecting you from the intense torture.
Exactly. You know, my interrogator was one of the horrendous torturers of Evin prison, and I was in Ward 4. Ward 4 belonged to NEK. Because an NEK follower gave my name, so I had to go to NEK ward. And then I was the only one who didn't believe in God among the prisoners, because I was in NEK, and I was among the communists, and they were calling me the chief communist came in again every single day. And he did not touch me. That guy was a rapist. That guy was the horrendous torturer. He didn't touch me. He did not. He did use the word you as plural, not as singular you, as a respect. Don't raise your head, because if you raise your head while you're sitting in here behind the door, they can hit on your head. So, Shabnam, don't raise your head when you are. Don't look. Don't try to open your blindfold, you know, because we are blindfolded. Don't open, don't push your whatever. And it was a piece of dirty cloth. Don't push this up, because if the guards see you, they can just hit on your head. But the person who tortured me was from another ward, because someone from a friend of family was arrested, and then they called in for interrogation, and then they asked, they gave my name, and then the interrogator from that ward called me in. And I was supposed to be freed after 6 months, because they couldn't find any evidence that I was politically active.
Right.
But because of that interrogator and that ward, that he was going to send me for more torture and execution most likely, my interrogator asked for the court, and then I was immediately sent to the court, and I appeared in front of a mullah judge without any lawyer, nothing, only me and one person, the judge, in the room, and then he gave me the sentence. That was the whole thing, that, you know, why God really protected me. I always questioned. And every day for a few months, I had a mullah sitting in a room telling me for a few hours a day, sitting, and then I was given a Quran, and then I was given a book of Ms. Ayatollah Mutahhari, another mullah scholar who was a very powerful guy in early Khomeini's time, and I think he was assassinated by NEK maybe a couple years after revolution. So I was given those books to read and understand about Islam. So I finished Quran twice in prison. And I said, no, I don't believe in this religion. So they were asking me, it's time to pray for Salat. Go for prayer. I was telling them, no, I don't believe in God. And no, Randy, I was not tortured for this. And this, you know, many, many girls and boys in that age, many Iranian prisoners in that age were executed for raising such voice. But I was alive. I don't understand why, what happened to me. And then when I was transferred to Fazal Hisar prison, we had time to go outside for half an hour every day just to get a little bit of a fresh air. And it was the fresh air time, and as I had written before, it was a very, very hot, sultry August. And, you know, I noticed, like, the day before you walk, you know, every single centimeter, an inch of the place, the pavement you walk in, because you don't see anything else and you just pay attention to your surroundings. I noticed that the asphalt was quite solid. Like 3 days after, again I'm walking and I noticed that the asphalt was broke out. And I look at this little weed coming out and I remember myself, that little tiny girl, like a skinny bone girl, sitting and bending over that little weed. And I'm looking at it, wow, how did this happen? How can this very solid asphalt be broken by tiny little weed? And that tiny little weed was the light of Christ in my heart and in my soul.
Wow.
I had no idea that a few years after, I moved to Turkey to study in university in Turkey, and then I meet the missionaries who talked about Jesus and who showed the video of Jesus Christ to me and to my family. And again, I questioned the very same Jesus and the very same God. And I said, I cannot believe there is God. I could not believe there was God. And after seeing Jesus on the cross, and after studying about his life and about the good deeds he did for his people, and he was not a violent person. He was a man of love. I just said, you know, I don't believe there is God. What about Jesus? I really do like Jesus Christ. And I started talking to Jesus as a little girl. And it
a couple things I wanted to say. Mm-hmm. Yeah, just to interrupt you just for a second, sorry. A couple things that you said. You saw the Jesus film, and the Jesus film has been used all over the world to touch the hearts of many, many non-believers. But you could not get away from that scene of when Jesus was dying on the cross, because you mentioned he was a man of love. What you're seeing in the Islam in Iran is hatred and violence and submission and fear, and yet you see in Jesus peace, compassion, and love.
You know, Randy, not probably. God talks to us through our experiences. God touches our lives through our experiences and who we are and our characters and how we are raised. I was in heaven. I saw torture, and I saw Jesus being tortured. So maybe that was the reason it touched me.
Yes.
And that was the moment that I went, you know, stepped back, and I thought about it, that this guy is saying, forgive them. This guy is healing the ear of the guy who was going to kill him. He puts his hand on the ear and says, no, don't be violent. I am healing. And, you know, we have one enemy, that is devil, that is Satan. Our fight and our battle is with Satan, not with man. So the Iranian church was very strong in Turkey. I lived in Ankara, Turkey. I was not, we were not refugees there. We moved to Turkey for over 7 years, 7.5 years, the whole family, with my brothers and my mom and my dad. So, we established there. We noticed that they were like, I have just to open like a little quote that we met an American missionary who used to be a missionary in Iran before, and who knew Persian language very well. He was very fluent in Persian. So we met the guy in Ankara, and then through that guy, we met a group of missionaries who were working in Turkey, and they were young ladies. And by accident, they were our neighbors. So they invited us to their home, and then we became friends. So one of the nights that, you know, they invited us, they showed us the Jesus video from Luke Gospel. And over there, they told me that, why don't you come and watch? And I said, no, I help you in the kitchen and do the dishes. You guys can watch your movie. I'm not interested in watching biblical movie because I don't believe there is God. But while I was going back and forth from kitchen to the living room, I noticed that scene, Jesus being on the cross and, you know, the temptation of Christ. Like parts of the movie, I watched it. And it really touched my heart. So when I go home that night, I had a dream. And in my dream, I saw a light talking to me and telling me that God is telling me, or whatever, that light was telling me that I am giving you 9 horses. One of the horses is white. I want you to sit on the white horse and ride on the white horse, and I give you, put on your head a crown, and you will be very happy the rest of your life. I woke up. I was shocked. Like, what was that? And I started just talking into my head and connecting through the Freud's interpretation of dream, because, you know, I studied that area. And I said, no, probably it was last night and the movie that I had watched, and maybe that's, you know, the the influence of that movie is bothering me. What is this like? Then I called my friend, my missionary friend who was from Germany. Her name was Emila. I said, Emila, I have this, before I go to university, first thing in the morning, I said, I have this dream. And she says, before go to school, can you just pop by to our house? I said, no problem. She opens the Bible, Revelation. And then she's showing me the verse about, you know, the horse and the crown and the white horse. And I said, come on, Emila, I can't believe there is God. God doesn't exist. God is in our heart. God is our guts. God is our conscience. So she says, you ask me about the dream? I'm just telling you. I said, okay, goodbye. Another day, again, and another few months. And then I said, you know, I am very, very surprised to see you guys talk to your God or whatsoever, whosoever it is, with joy and with music. Because when I grew up in Iran, talking to God with music is sin. You don't go to God through musical instrument. You have to always mourn.
Yes.
You have to always ask for forgiveness. You are never forgiven. Everything you do is written in your left shoulder and right shoulder. There is an angel coming from heaven, writes all your good deeds on your right and bad deeds on your left shoulder. So how come you guys don't mourn? And how come you are living almost in poverty in Turkey, like because of the missionaries, and they had like a fixed income? I said, you have this ultimate joy that I can't find that in me. I'm coming from a very wealthy family. I don't even pay for my tuition. I don't need to work. My father does everything, and, you know, I don't even cook. I don't do anything. I just go to school and come home and study. And you guys are working so hard, but I can't have that joy you have. Why do you have that joy and I don't have it? So I attended their church group, home church group gatherings. And as I told you before, the Iranian church was very strong in Ankara, in Istanbul. And they heard about me. Oh, there is an Iranian girl who wants to come to our, who is coming to our gatherings, our Sunday gatherings. So the Persian church pressured the international group. And they told the leader of the group I was attending, their church, that since we have an Iranian church in Ankara and it's not very far from their house, why doesn't she come to the Iranian church? In one of the meetings, the pastor's wife, I wasn't even believing in God, but I was enjoying that musical fellowship with guitars and with a little bit of the organ. I really, really enjoyed it because I loved music. So they said, Shabnam, I am so sorry. The pastor in Iranian church asked that you should not come here and you should attend other church. Remember? There's no way you can do this to me. Why on earth I have to go to my nation's church? Why? Because I'm Iranian and because I speak Farsi? No way. I said to the pastor's wife, can you open your Bible and tell me that your Jesus or your God is telling that in the Bible that I have to attend a gathering or a fellowship that people of my language attend? I am fluent in English, and you guys don't have even a problem. I help you in Turkish language. So why do you want to get rid of me? I said, you know what? Sorry. If your Jesus come to this earth, I would not believe in him anymore. I'm done with your God or with your Jesus. I left the church. It took like one year, Randy. I had another dream, one more dream before I became a Christian, like two more. And I saw a piece of, but I never stopped my friendship with my missionary neighbors. We were friends, but I said, no, I'm not interested in godly stuff. It's too much, and there is no difference between this and what happens in Iran is dictatorship. I believe in freedom. I believe in democracy. I believe in choice. You guys didn't give me the choice if you wanted me to accept Jesus as my Savior, you had to let me attend your group, but you stopped me of coming. So I saw in my dream that that time was the time that I was doing my thesis for my bachelor degree. I saw my professor, thesis professor, handing me in a flat, like a, you know, the flat bread, not pita bread. It's like an African injera bread that is very flat and very soft. That piece of rolled bread was given to me by my thesis professor in my dream. And then I looked at that, and among the group that he gave me, there was a pregnant woman. And culturally, when there is someone pregnant and there is food, you have to share because that pregnant woman might want a little bit of a taste of food and the baby wants it. This cultural thing, okay, in Middle Eastern. So I looked at that, and I said, okay, because my professor gave me the bread, I give one piece to my professor, I give one piece to that woman in the crowd, the pregnant woman, and I kept the middle piece to myself. As soon as I started opening the bread to read, I read Psalm. In my dream, Psalm. The voice that was in my head was Psalm, Psalm, Psalm. In Farsi means Mazamir. Mazmur means Psalm. So I woke up with that Psalm voice in my head. I went to my mother. It was 7 a.m. I think my course started at 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock. I said to my mom, what is Psalm? I looked at my Old Testament. There is nothing like that in it in the index. Like, what is Psalm? Is it kind of a dish, like Mazmur? My mom says, this is the Old Testament. Come and read this. So I read the whole 150 chapters of Psalm that night, that day, that morning. I read. And I said, wow, can you talk to God like David did? That is amazing. Can you yell at God? This is an interesting God. I like that God, I said. Like, and imagine I was just very young. I wasn't that, just again, I was in youth, you know, age, and in my youth. And it was, like, amazing. I called Irmila, and I said, Irmila, I had this dream. She says, after school, come over, and we can have tea together. She says, Shabnam, God is calling you. Open your heart. I said, no, I cannot open my heart for God. If I open my heart, I die. How can I open my heart? No, I can't believe in God. I do believe in good deeds. I do believe in conscience, but I don't believe that there is an ultimate power over this universe. It's very hard for me to believe because this is impossible. And then she says, you know, I don't know what to say, but that's what you asked me. Randy, Irmila prayed and fasted for me for 1 year. Every Thursday, she was fasting for me. Fasting. Mm-hmm. My last dream.
It's amazing. It's amazing.
It is amazing.
You should.
There is power in fasting.
The prayer, the fasting, but I'm seeing something here that's just gripping my heart, how God understood your hardness of heart, your unbelief, but he spoke to you in a language you could understand. That is dreams. And he used dreams in your life, just like he's speaking to many Muslims today through visions and dreams, and they're coming to know Christ. I see the pattern here in your life. He took the things that you were attached to, music. The Bible is filled with psalms and music and crying out to God. He was reaching you right at your level, Shabnam.
Yes, yes. He talks to us individually, and he touches us based on our needs and individualism. So I had a dream. I remember I told Irmila and Isabel, my friend from Guatemala, and there was another older couple from Nova Scotia, Canada. They were George Bush and Emily. They were missionaries in Iran during Shah. And then they went to back to Canada and again to Turkey. So they were working with a Persian group who were thirsty about Jesus in Turkey. So Emila, I didn't know that they were missionaries. You know, now I know, but you know, I didn't know that time. So I just thought they are tourists who want to live there, because they wouldn't talk about missionary or mission work or what they were doing. I thought they are just there because of their faith, they had to go to church. So I had a dream, that it was Iranian New Year. It was Nowruz. And it coincides with 4 o'clock in the morning, like 4 or 4:30 in the morning that time when we entered to spring. So every year we enter to spring in different time. So 4:30, all of our family, as a tradition in my family, we had to dress and nicely and sit down until, you know, we enter to spring, hug each other, kiss each other, and then go to bed. So, but we all had to dress up. That's what my dad's, like, rule. So after that, it was Sunday. I went to, and it was, I think, very close, probably 2 days before Easter. So I don't remember exactly what year was it, but probably 24 years ago. I went to my bed. I knelt in front of my bed, into my bedroom. I knelt in front of my bed, looked at the window, and I said, kneeling, "You know, Jesus, I do like you." I said that. "I don't believe there is God. I cannot believe there is God, but I do like you. You're such a nice man. You didn't do anything wrong the way that they killed you and they tortured you. But would you please tell me what the truth is? I am looking everywhere in witchcrafting, fortune telling, Baha'i religion. I can't find something that I can cling. I need something. Communism is dead for me. Atheism is dead for me. No way I can become a Muslim or Baha'i. But I tried witchcrafting. I tried, you know, going to fortune telling. Tell me what is the truth. I want to hear from you. I don't like God. You tell me. I really like you. I didn't read this in the Bible that God says you have to become like a child to go to me. I didn't read this because Bible was boring to me. When you don't have the Spirit of God, you cannot understand the Word of God. You must to have the Spirit. Mm-hmm. So I said that, and then I went to bed. Maybe it was 5 o'clock in the morning. I had a dream that there was a white man, like a man dressed in white, and sun was shining from his behind, comes to me and tells me, what did he say? He said, "You ask me the truth, I tell you I am the truth. If you just say Jesus is the Son of God," and he talked to me in Persian, "if Jesus is the Son of God and I am a sinner, I will baptize you with my hands and I will always be with you and I will never leave you. When you wake up, you say that." I woke up. It was 7 o'clock in the morning. It was like Sunday, no school. I looked out into the window, my window, and I said, "Sin? I didn't do adultery. I didn't steal. I didn't kill. These three things are sin in that culture I was raised. Why do you have to say I'm a sinner? I'm not a sinner. What did I do wrong?" But then I could not control because the Spirit of God was in me because I asked him to help me. I asked.
That's right.
He says, "Knock on the door. It will be open. Ask, you will receive." So I asked.
Exactly.
And then I would never forget that moment, Randy. I suddenly felt, I said, "Jesus is the Son of God and I am a sinner." I felt my veins, my body, my soul, my skin, my muscles have been washed like you go to the car wash. It was amused. I don't know how to say. I was amused by the power that I was receiving in me. And then I suddenly find out that I have that joy, the joy that I was very much envious of, Ermila and Isabel's joy. I had it. I reached my telephone Sunday morning. Maybe it was 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock. I don't remember. I called, "Hello, Ermila. Can I come to your church today?" And, Shabnam, the girl would never, if I said no, it's a no. There is no way I can bend. I said, "I really would love to come to your church today and share my testimony. So Emila said to me, why? I said, I had this dream last night, and I want to talk to God, and I want to tell him that I believe in God, but I believe in the God, that God that Jesus introduced to me. And then Emila told me, you know, Shabnam, you know that I never lie. Because, convenience lie was another thing that really struck me. Why don't you say lie, even a little lie? They said, in our faith, we cannot lie, not even a convenient lie. So I said, yeah, I know you never lie. She said, 2 o'clock in the morning, I was asleep. God woke me up and told me to pray for you and invite you to church today. The time that New Year happened, I went to bed. Before going to bed, I knelt and prayed. Emila was preparing me to go to God. There is power in prayers and in fasting.
Yes. And what I like about what you shared, Chad, ma'am, was that you were asking God to show you the truth. And the scripture says, Jesus says, I am the way, and I am the truth, and I am the life. And so when you ask God, he's going to tell you the truth because Jesus says, I am the truth.
And I never read these things in the Bible. Bible was boring to me. I didn't want it. I was reading the Bible one page from everywhere. I could not understand that language that time. It was the language of religion. I could not believe it. Culture, religion, old-fashioned thing. I couldn't understand that. I just didn't like it. I didn't know that I had to ask God. You know, I didn't know that he was the one. I didn't know that he was the truth. I had no idea about this. I just watched that little Jesus video. And then I went a few times to the Christian gatherings, which I was just not even listening to the scripture reading. I was amazed with the music and the joy they had. But the pride in me was wiped out, was gone. I had that pride. I say no, it's a no. I had no problem of apologizing, even if it wasn't my fault. I had no problem with saying I was wrong. But I went there. It was the Easter gathering, and everybody from across Turkey came. They rented a hotel room, like a banquet room in the hotel, main hotel in Turkey, in downtown Ankara, and everybody came for Easter meeting. So I went there with kind of being a little bit shy, shyness in me. I remember there was a little, like a mini piano there, and somebody was playing the piano. And after they called me to go and just share my testimony or whatever I wanted to say to the church, I thanked everybody for praying for me, and I asked God, I said, you know, God, would you please take away the dust from my heart, as this little piano, it has no dust, and it's shining, and use me for thy service. I said that. I had no idea why I was saying that. I said, I want to be your servant, and I want to serve you anywhere I go. So I told them that I don't want to be baptized in Turkey because of the Iranian church and of the Buddhist refugees who just wanted to come out of Iran and using Christianity as a case. I didn't want anybody to think I'm one of them. We applied to come to Canada, and our visa was on the way that time. So, you know, probably within 2-3 months we were leaving. So I said, no, I don't want to be baptized. I will be baptized when I leave here and I go to Canada. So I came to Canada, and George Bush and Emily introduced me to their friends. We moved to London, Ontario at that time, and I had no idea about different part of Christianity and denominations in Christianity, because most of the church was Baptist church in you know, where those Christians I met. So that was a Open Brethren church in London, Ontario. And boy, no. I learned about Christ heavily, you know, in that church.
Yes.
And I became very active with that Open Brethren church. I was baptized there. And shortly after, I was involved with Transworld Radio, and the head of Transworld Radio Canada gave me the Book of Job to translate. Book of Job.
What a challenge.
The Bible. Oh, that was a killer. And
yes.
Then after Jesus the Carpenter, that was the second book I translated for children. And it was Mrs. G's Stories books. And there was a Canadian older, like she was in mid-80s. I don't remember her name, but the book name that she had, Mrs. G Story. And she wrote many, many books from the Bible. So then I put all those books into radio programming, especially with the Book of Job. I had to become God. I was Job's wife. I was devil. I was Job's children. I was those like women and men around. But God touched me through that book.
Yes.
And prepared
yes.
me for the heartache. So this
you know,
is
the
my
things you're sharing with me. Yes, I'm thankful for a couple of things. Don't mean to interrupt you there. A couple things I want to share with you to our audience is one of the famous theologians and philosophers and church fathers, St. Augustine, said, our hearts are restless until mm-hmm. they find their rest in you. And your heart was restless. It was hard. It was a hardened heart. It says there's no God, but it was restless until you found true rest and true peace in Jesus. You went to fortune tellers. You went to every kind of occult practice, and your heart was restless. And just like Augustine said, it's restless until it finds its rest in Jesus.
Amen. You know, I have been humiliated by many Iranian activists about my faith a lot, mm-hmm. but they don't have that, so it's normal for them because I used to humiliate people. So I don't blame mm-hmm. them because unless you have the Spirit of God, you can understand. Then you don't have, the only thing is we have to pray for them and we have to
yes.
ask for forgiveness for them. And you know, Randy, there is no way Middle East will be freed if, unless the Christian community from all little churches, Catholic, Protestant, and Orthodox, get together and pray in unity for the Spirit of God to be raised in the Middle East and to go to the hearts of the Middle Eastern, there is no peace in the Middle East. Middle Eastern, they have to put that cup down on the ground and go to the real God.
Yes, yes. And you talking about the Middle East just before you came on, I was talking about the endurance and the strong faith of the Iraqi Christians facing
mm-hmm.
genocide there. And I'm
yes.
thinking ISIS is a militant butcher group. Their God is a God of hatred and violence and discrimination. And these precious Iraqi Christians are standing firm in the midst of this terror. And you're right, there is no hope and there is no healing in the Middle East except the healing and the hope that comes through Christ. And the same with Iran. We do our human rights, Shabnam. We speak out for the oppressed. But the real hope for Iran, as well as the Middle East, is Jesus. And you're living proof of that.
You know, Catholic Church in Iran has forsaken God. Catholic Church, Orthodox Church in Iran, they are, you know, imagine Catholic Church has a member of parliament in Tehran, in the parliament of Iran. They don't follow this route. And, you know, it's just they have to be in unity. They have to really, really proclaim their faith. And they have to walk on the footstep of Jesus Christ, not on the footstep of devil, evil regime of Iran. So all of my Christian friends, they are telling me that they're telling me that we have to unite as Christians and pray and fast for the Middle East, for the peace in the Middle East.
I agree. Okay, I agree. With our couple minutes left, Shabnam, I have many, many friends in Iran that I send my Cross in the Desert program to, just like you did with your radio program. They are able, in some cases, to overcome the filtering and listen. And many, many of my friends in Iran are burnt out in religion. And they have really no hope. They're just struggling to stay alive. What is the message of hope you would have to my friends in Iran that listen to this program? What can you tell them in just a few minutes to give them hope again?
I would say just ask Jesus and he will show you the road and the way. And leave your burden onto his shoulder. He will carry you. He would never leave you alone. And if God planted his seed, he would not let that seed to be rotten. He will protect you because he is the God of miracles. And ask that God of miracle just to show you the way. He would never forsake you. He would never leave you. Trust in him. And be a shining star for your family when you believe in Jesus. You don't need to talk about Jesus. Your action should change everybody around you. We don't need to talk. We don't need to say, hello, I'm a Christian. I go to the church. I pray like that. No, we are not Pharisees. We have to act as Jesus acted on this earth for 33 years when he was here among us. He is the God of miracle. And it is not that difficult to understand that Father, Son, and Holy Spirit is one. It's not that difficult. It's not anti-religion, because I always believe this. When God has that ultimate power to create the universe and to create me from the earth, can that very same God to bring his own spirit to this world and to walk among us as a person? Is it that difficult for that God that in Islamic religion they say this is a sin to believe like that? Why? What is so difficult for a Muslim to understand that Jesus is the Son of God who was the Spirit of God, and God wanted to come among us and to live with us for these years so we can see him as an example and follow his footprint? You just tell them, all my dear Iranian friends who are listening, trust in Jesus and ask him. He will show you the road. God bless you, Randy.
Well, God bless you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for sharing.
Thank you, Shabnam, for sharing in detail. I love the way that you meticulously detailed your testimony from beginning to end. And that's important that our listeners understand just how God was shaping your life from a young teenager today. And thank you for not leaving out any facts. Those details are important. You've been listening to Shabnam Esadli, an Iranian-Canadian human rights activist, but most importantly, a woman that loves her God and her Lord Jesus. And her goal is to do human rights, but also to tell people about the healing and the power and the love of Christ. Thank you so much for joining me on The Cross in the Desert, Shabnam.
God bless you, and thank you so much for having me on your show.
You have a great day, and thank you for
you
being
too.
My
thank
guest.
You.
And that was Shabnam Esadli, and the reason I dedicated my book to her and to Shadi Pave, they are two living examples of wonderful human beings that love the truth and do so much hard work in the area of human rights. And they speak for the oppressed and the hurting in Iran. They are both my dear friends, and I thank them so much for being a big part of my life. Well, you've been listening to Shabnam Esadli and her great testimony of how she met Christ in all the circumstances that she went through as a young Iranian teenager. I want to leave you with this important song from a group known as Sidewalk Prophets, who talk about the love of Christ in a very brilliant way, and this song is called Lay Down My Life. We're going to listen to it right now on The Cross in the Desert.
All your pain will be made mine. All your trouble, tears you cry, give it up, all that binds. I will place it on my shoulder, and up this hill I'll climb. Father, give me strength, I know there is no other way, so I lay down my life for you.
Sidewalk Prophets, I laid down my life. The Good Shepherd Jesus portrays himself as, I laid down my life for my sheep. I have come, Jesus says, to give you life and life more abundantly. With the last few minutes in today's extended special program with my dear friend Shabnam, her wonderful testimony, I want to leave you with some thoughts from my new book, Chasing After Rainbows, Stories of the Revolution. I dedicated this book to Shabnam and Shadi, both incredible human rights activists, powerful voices. And I want to read to you in this book a scene. And let me set this up to you. Sahar has discovered that her best friend, Shabnam, has been on death row in Iran for distributing Bibles. And without giving you all of the things that happened in the book, by the grace of God, Shabnam is freed from death row, and Sahar goes into Turkey, and they meet for the first time after 35 years. And I want to read to you this scene in the book. Remember, they're in Ankara, Turkey. Sahar has been fighting, petitioning, speaking out for her best friend that she hasn't seen in 35 years. And you can imagine the emotion of the moment when they meet for the first time 35 years later. The last time they met was right before the Iranian Revolution. And Shabnam is sitting down with Sahar in this tiny apartment in Ankara, Turkey. They've actually had a little Nowruz celebration together. But she's turning now to Sahar and saying, here's how I survived being in Evin prison and tortured as a Christian. And here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to read this to you. She says, Sahar, I could have never survived without Jesus. His words were life to me, strength to me, and without them I would have died. Shabnam looked intently into Sahar's eyes. Remember those long talks on the beach when I would ask questions about God and you were busy daydreaming about boys? Sahar and Shabnam giggled together. Well, one day, it was about a year after the revolution begun, two young girls approached me in the streets of Tehran and offered me a copy of the New Testament. Shabnam's eyes glowed with joy. I remember returning home and devouring it. The words of Jesus spoke to my heart, bread of life. Whoever comes to me will never go hungry, and whoever believes in me will never be thirsty. Come to me, all you who are weary and heavy burdens, and I will give you rest. For God so loved the world that he gave his one and only Son, that whoever believes in him will not perish, but have everlasting life. Shabnam paused, overcome with emotion. I knew the minute I read these beautiful words of Jesus that I had found what I was searching for. Sahar, for the first time in my life, I had hope. I felt fulfilled, and most importantly, I had discovered the treasure I had been searching for. I had found true love and acceptance in Christ. Shabnam's eyes filled with tears. I remember one night, after a brutal interrogation and beating, I laid face down in blood on the cold, hard cell floor and cried out to Jesus, praying to be free. I wept, I prayed, and I find myself even praying for my interrogators. Shabnam wiped the tears away from her eyes, and her face suddenly beamed with joy again. Then, to my utter amazement, I was told that I was one of the prisoners to be released for the Nowruz celebration. Sahar hugged Shabnam tightly. My prayers had been answered. Later, my uncle told me that he had a long talk with one of the higher-ups in the regime, and they had made a huge financial deal together. My uncle had to sell the deed to his property, worth more than 800 million tomans, and if he did that, they would ensure my release after Nowruz. Sahar's eyes grew wide with shock and excitement. That is incredible. That has never happened before, that a prisoner on death row was released after Nowruz. Shabnam smiled. As I said, being here with you is nothing short of a miracle from Jesus. From my book, Chasing After Rainbows, Shabnam, the real Shabnam, shared with us today that indeed God is a God of grace and love and miracles. He wants to give you hope again. Your ultimate hope, if you're an Iranian living in Iran under the oppression of an Iranian regime, your ultimate hope is not only in having a new government. You can have a new government that has more freedom. You can have a new government that allows you to do things differently than the old government did, but you're still a prisoner. You see, Jesus says, he who the Son sets free is free indeed. Well, we have to be set free from something, and it's a bondage called sin. You can have a new government and more freedom, but you're still in bondage to something called sin. And that sin is those inner demons inside of you that struggle against you. We have all sinned, the Bible said, and have fallen short of God's glory. We have all broken his holy law. And we are all prisoners of sin. And Jesus has the key to unlock the prison cell and set you free. That's hard for us as human beings to believe that we are in bondage to something called sin. But as I've said to you, you can live in an oppressive regime and one day have a free Iran. And that's wonderful. All of us as human rights activists speak out and pray and fight for this. But there is still a problem. You can be physically free, but spiritually still in bondage. And Jesus has come to give you a freedom that a government cannot give you, but a freedom to be all that God has created you to be. He who the Son sets free, Jesus says, is free indeed. And so when I talk to my Iranian friends and I pray with them, I share my books with them, and I talk about a new government, a free Iran, I never fail to always mention that the ultimate freedom is not found in having a new government, but it's found in the treasure of knowing Christ. You see, in my book, Shabnam was saying to Sahar, Sahar, I could have never endured what I did without Christ. Knowing that he was in the center of my life, that he lived in my heart, that his words meant more to me than anything in this world, I knew beyond anything that the ultimate freedom was found in Christ, and I couldn't have survived without it. You see, in my book, Sahar is kind of like Shabnam. She doesn't really believe there is a God. She's busy doing all of these other things, and she really doesn't really connect with any so-called God of the universe. But when she meets her friend again, 35 years later, her friend is saying to her, Sahar, remember those days on the beach when I was asking questions about God and you were chasing after boys in your imagination? You were thinking of coming into America, starting a new life. And she was saying to Sahar, God answered all of my questions. Remember, Shabnam said that she asked God for the truth. She sought after God to know the truth. She questioned God, and God answered her. This is reality. This is real life. God wants you to know him personally. There is a God of the universe who is righteous and just, but he's full of love and compassion, and he desires to connect with you. He desires to open your heart and mind to a reality that you never dreamed of, to a treasure that you can discover, and that treasure is found in Christ. And so what I would like to say to you in closing is, as you've listened to our program today and heard Shabnam share her incredible, amazing testimony, that same God that changed Shabnam's life wants to change yours, wants to open your heart and mind to a love that you have never thought existed. And as you look around at all the hatred and evil in the world, there is a love that wants to wrap its arms around you. The Iraqi Christians, their only means of survival is Jesus. They refused to recant. They held on to their faith. And although they had to flee their homes and run away, they would never forsake their Lord. You see, Jesus died to forgive us and rose again to give us new life. And so I invite you today to know the God that Shabnam knows and to know the God that I know. He can set you free and give you a new life that is filled with his joy and his love. And I invite you to know him today. If you have any questions, any comments, please come to my Facebook page, Randy L. Noble. I will be glad to send you my books, to talk with you, to pray with you, to be your friend. I really appreciate your time today on this special broadcast, and I look forward to seeing you this Thursday for another edition of The Cross in the Desert. God bless you, and have an incredible week.